It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Jim Dolan. We're continuing with our exhibition of new programming on the Radio Theater Channel, which is streaming at oldtimeradiolisten.com. And that's on all the time, so you should check it out. But to give you some more incentive, we're playing a few of the new programs, and we're going to play this hour the Kevin Curtis Show and a surprise program at the end. So here we go with the Kevin Curtis Show.
The time, now. The place, here. Let's go with the Kevin Curtis Show.
The regularly scheduled program, the Kevin Curtis Show, will be preempted because he's still out to lunch.
Fooled you again. I packed my own lunch, and I have it right here.
Rats.
The Kevin Curtis Show, probably one of the greatest shows ever to be put on radio. Yes. Why would you even want to listen to the BBC when you can listen to this station? Why, the best way to listen to the Kevin Curtis Show is sitting in your easy chair with your feet up, drinking a nice soda, and smoking a big cigar. Yes, nothing can be finer than listening to my show.
Never mind, I'm a busy man. Look, I'm an agent. Who are you?
Beethoven, sir.
You'll have to change it. What have you got then? Is it commercial? If not, why not?
I've got a tune, sir. It's a song, and you're not got any words.
Is it R&B, folk, minuet, gavotte? Who cares? So let's hear it. Can you whistle?
Well, I brought along a few friends to play it for
you.
Ah,
good. Well, give us your song then. Come on, swing it. Let's hear it.
Eins, zwei, drei.
Well, that's a load of old rubbish, isn't it? And mind you never can tell. Tchaikovsky does it. Why not you? Of course, the arrangement's wrong. What's in there?
20 violins, 10 violas, 8 cellos, 4 basses, and a brass section.
Try it on guitar. Ah, that's more like it. That's more like it. Now, jazz it up a bit. Come on, jazz it up. Give it a bit of rhythm. Da-da-da-da. That's good. It's good. It's good. It's coming. It's coming. Hey, I'll tell you what's wrong.
What?
The tune. Try it going up. Try it going up.
Ha-da-da.
I like it. Yes, it's coming. It's coming. Wait a minute. I've got it.
Once again, the Ludwig van Prune tune spotlights the talents of Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, David Hatch, Joe Kendall, and Bill Oddie. And here, towering under the microphone, is your own, your very own, John Otto Cleese.
I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Again. Oh, I'd love to be alone in the country.
John?
Yes?
I'm with you.
I'd love to be alone in the country.
But John, you brought me with you.
I didn't. You hid in the back.
But you must have noticed.
Not at all. It's a very large tandem.
But John, when we fell off going down the stairs... You must have seen me.
I thought you were a hitchhiker.
But I'm your wife. You must have recognized me.
I didn't, Mary.
Why not?
Well, because you were disguised as a cactus.
Oh, John. John. Talk to me. Say something to me. Say you hate me. Say I'm ugly.
Which?
Say I'm ugly.
You're ugly.
You're only saying that. You don't really mean it. You don't care. You never think about me. Up and down all night, warming the milk, mashing the rust, all the crying and the bedwetting.
Yes, I know.
I wouldn't mind if we had a baby.
Well, I'm sorry, but I prefer bisons.
John, why don't you admit it? You don't love me anymore.
All right, I admit it.
John, once we had something that was pure and wonderful and good. What's happened to it?
You spent it all.
That's all that matters to you, isn't it? Money. I despise you. Do you hear me? I hate you. I don't know how I've been able to stand it. I suppose it's because I love you. I don't know. I do love you, John. I love you more than I can say. I need you, John. Please, John, don't look at photographs of nude women while I'm talking to you.
All right, but I know you know.
You know?
Yes.
Oh, God. John.
Yes?
What do you know?
Well, I could be wrong.
You mean about me and Nigel?
Oh, I was wrong. I thought it was Rupert.
You're right, it is Rupert. I can never remember names.
Anyway, I do know about last Friday.
Last Friday?
Yes. He was in my bed, wasn't he?
How did you know?
He kept pushing me out.
You mean you were there too?
You didn't even notice?
Oh, God.
John. Try to love me.
No, Mary, it's no good. You somehow managed to hurt everyone you love.
Well, I'll take the cactus skin off.
No, Mary, look. There's something I've been meaning to tell you.
What?
Cardinal Richelieu died in 1642.
All right, so Mother was wrong. But can't we forget the past? I mean, that's all history now. Don't let's dig it up again.
You never liked me being an archaeologist, did you?
I never said that.
You'd have been happier if I'd sharpened knives or sold ferrets.
Keep George out of this.
No. I'm not going to keep George out of this. If you had to have a lover, why did it have to be a ferret seller? Blasted ferrets all over the house for months. Why couldn't it have been the budgerigar man? At least budgerigars can sing beautifully. I can still remember waking up in the morning and hearing all those ferrets singing. It used to drive me mad. Always the same tune.
Well, that's all over now. Can't we forget it? I mean, couldn't we start all over again? I mean, go back and begin from the beginning.
I suppose we could try.
Please, John.
All right. Oh, how I love to be alone in the country. How I love to be alone in the country.
But, John, you...
It's time now for another in the series, Stories from Shakespeare, told by David Pushoff.
Hello, children. Now, gather round and I'll tell you all a tale. Once upon a time, and not so very long ago, there lived in a very cold place called Denmark a young fellow by the name of Hamlet. He lived with his mother, Elsie, and his wicked stepfather, Norman, in a great big palace called Elsie North. Now, Hamlet was a good boy and loved his mother. But he was very jealous of his wicked stepfather, the King of Denmark, no less. And so, one day, Hamlet decided to do away with his wicked stepfather. And that night, he told his mother about it. She was astounded. Oi, oi, she cried. Is this my little boy? But Hamlet had made up his mind already. And so he cunningly got hold of some deadly, undetectable poison from the delicatessen on the corner and put it in a glass of wine. But who should drink the wine but his own mama? What confusion! People running to and fro, as like as not. And Hamlet's girlfriend Ophelia jumping in the river. And did she have problems? So Hamlet picked up a sword with a poisoned point, which was lying around, and stabbed his wicked stepfather. But it just wasn't his lucky day. Hamlet accidentally scratched himself with the poisoned sword, and that was that. Well, children, next week I'll tell you the story of Macbeth, another murder story. And nobody murders stories like I do.
We are now interrupting the program with news of an unhappy event. We are deeply grieved to announce that tomorrow at 12 o'clock midday, the Earth is due to be destroyed by falling into the sun. First, the Prime Minister's reaction. The nation as a whole is taking the news calmly. Since the Earth is due to be destroyed at midday, tomorrow will be a day of mourning. For first reactions from Fleet Street, over to what the papers say.
Well, several of today's papers lead with the story of the world's destruction. Typical headlines are the Mirrors.
Wow, which bikini weather?
And the Express.
Save our royal family.
Owing to the news of the world's impending destruction, the BBC announces a change in its programmes for tonight. At 9 o'clock, the Prime Minister will address the nation, if he can be found in time. And now, in place of our advertised program, 24 hours, we have a special program, 12 hours.
And first of all, we've been asked to ask you not to panic.
Panic!
I'm panicking.
And now, sport. Over to the president of the FA.
The two semi-finals of the FA Cup have been brought forward and will be played at 8 o'clock this evening. The final will be played at 10:30 tomorrow morning. There'll be no extra time.
Well, while we were hearing that report, a listener has rung in to say that he's just heard the last cuckoo. And now, Darcy Fish.
When he heard the news today, walking down Tottenham Court Road with his banner, Mr. Fred Peer, chairman of the End of the World Is at Hand Society, died of shock.
And that is the end of the news. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. That is the news of the end. There are plenty of songs about the joys of eating. But how about a song to help people slim? Here from Bill Oddie and the Boys is a cautionary tale.
Uncle Henry bought himself some teeth the other day, and he was so excited he got carried right away. He was chewing day and night, chomping everything in sight. He even made the furniture and half a dog as well. I tell you, Uncle Henry simpered on and on. And as a rule, he's only eight. When we rolled him on the scale, its little face went pale, and a tiny voice inside was heard to murmur, "Very faint. Shake it off,
baby, off.
Shake it off,
baby, off.
No, you can't be seen in public, not like that. Now I know it may seem ruthless, but you were better toothless. Now everybody says you're far too fat.
Well,
Lulu was a stripper and she had just what it takes. In generous proportions, built on lemon juice and steaks. And when she needed snuffing, instead of eating muffin, she'd have one of those rolls that when you bite into the crust, there's nothing. But our Lulu dropped our diet, she just went astray. She started eating bread and bones and grew a bit each day. Till one night in her dance, she showed such a vast expanse that as she went to drop the lot, she heard a fella say, "Take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off!
Oh, you can't go out in public, not like that.
Now you're
trapped. Yeah, blimey, look at you. You've got enough for two.
Set among the desolate Yorkshire moors stands an ominous cluster of grey stone buildings whose walls withstood the ravages of the centuries. From this grim fortress, none have ever been known to escape. For this is Grimbody Keep, one of England's largest public schools. This is the setting for today's classic story, Tim Brown's School Days.
Grimbody Keep. What happy memories I carry in my heart of that grey, moss-covered, crumbling ruin, the headmaster, Mr. Thatcher. I recall the friends of my youth who stood beside me in times of trouble and never lifted a finger to help. Oh, and I remember Betty, the milkmaid, who was so dear to all of us boys, though only half price to the masters. One of my happiest recollections is of cooking by an open fire till I was quite done on both sides. Oh, golden memories indeed. But let me take you back with me to that moment long ago when I stood, a fresh-faced, apple-cheeked young lad, before the gates of Grimbody Keep for the very first time. Said.
You rang, sir?
I had to. The bell was broken. I am Tim Brown, the new boy.
Well, step inside, young.
He said.
Fellow, I have to keep the door shut on account of the wolves.
Surely there aren't any wolves out on the moors.
Bless you, no, sir. They're inside. Headmaster keeps them for amusement. He sets them on the matron every now and again.
Oh, I see. Are you one of the masters here?
Bless you, no, sir.
Well, what is your position?
I'm usually hunched up like this. First of all, you must go and see Mr. Thatcher, the headmaster. You like him. He's a regular gentleman. Takes castor oil twice a day. Now, come here. This is his study, so in you go and good luck.
Come in, whoever you are.
He chortled.
Come in, dear boy.
He said.
Come in, he repeated. Shut the door behind you. We don't want Brutus to escape, now do we?
Is Brutus your dog?
No, he's the Latin master. Well, well, what a clean-limbed, healthy young lad you are, to be sure. But we'll soon put that right. Now then, what's your name?
Tim Brown, sir.
Brown, eh? Well, I'm sure we'll be chums. You live in room 13. It's a single room. But I'm afraid you'll have to share. Still, I'm sure you won't mind. The other 25 don't.
That night, I lay awake looking through the dormitory window and wishing I was inside. Oh, next morning, it was time for our history lesson with old Mr. Totteridge, who was a little hard of hearing.
Good morning, boys.
Good morning, Mr.
Oh dear, they can't have arrived yet. Well, never mind. I'll carry on without them. Yes, that's what I'll do. I'll carry on. That's it. Yes, I'll carry on without them. Yes.
Please, sir, we're here.
Oh, there you are. I was going to carry on without you, you know. But as you're here, I won't bother. Goodbye.
Sir, tell us about
Lynn
the
Conqueror. Ah, yes. Now, there was a great lady. I knew her, you know. She was a very absolutely marvelous. She was a very, very good friend, a friend of mine. And I was taking her, I well remember, I was taking her to a day. I was going to take her to dinner one night, and I'm not boring you, am I?
It was 2 hours later when we filed out of the classroom. It took us that long to get through the bars. As we... No, as we returned to schoolhouse, a freckled-faced young lad took my elbow and ran off with it. I caught up with him and he introduced himself.
Hello, my name's Dobkins Minor. You must be Tim Brown, the new boy. Let's slope off to the tuck shop. I expect Mrs. Greystone will be glad to meet you.
Whiz up, come on.
The school tuck shop was a wonderland to my youthful gaze, full of marvelous sweeties who sat around in their underwear. Mrs. Greystone produced two huge cakes, one chocolate and one strawberry. I had a bit of the chocolate and Dobkins had a bit of the other. Suddenly the door burst open and a tall, rugged boy with dark, evil hair and a broken voice swaggered in. It was Flashman, the school bully.
So, what are we here? What's your name, Pipsqueak?
Tim Brown.
Can you fight Brown?
No, but I can see red.
That's not very funny.
Well, I'm rather nervous.
Look here, Flashman. I'm not going to let you hit Brown before my face.
All right, I'll hit your face first. Come on, Brown.
No, no, fighting is wicked.
No, it isn't.
It is the way I fight. Take that.
Oh! You bit my nose. That's not fair. Right, you're in for a good hiding. I'll put you in the broom cover. They'll never find you there.
Now, come along, boys. I made some tea, so why don't you have a cup and say you're sorry? Believe me, when you tasted it, you will be sorry.
All right, I apologize, Brown.
With that, Flashman spun on his heel, drilling a neat hole in the floor through which he fell. I was moved by his apology, but something he said as he left made me doubt his sincerity.
I'm a liar.
But no sooner had he left than a red-faced, well-built man entered. I knew at once that this was none other than Rudyard Kipling. But I was wrong.
Good heavens, it's Mr. Trimfettle, the games master.
Yes, I say hello, Mrs. G. I say I'm sorry to bother you and all that. But I'm a little short of cash. I wonder, could I touch you for 5 bob? You see, the trouble is, we're playing harrow or rugby at rugger or soccer on Saturday. Or it may be cricket. Anyway, point is, we haven't got a team, you see. And I'm in a terrible state and I just don't know what to do with myself.
Please, sir.
Don't say it.
I can play rugger.
Can you? I say that's first rate. Now, look. Now, look, I suppose we'll need one or two other chaps to make up the team.
Rugger teams don't wear makeup, sir.
No. Well, I know so little about games. I did extra singing when I was at school.
And so we started at once. It was quite a job, as most of the team had never played before. But I hit upon the ruse of putting itching powder in their beds, and they were soon up to scratch. Before the match, Flashman gave the team a pep talk.
All right, you snivelling bunch of lily-livered poltroons. We'll be playing on our own home ground, so that's an advantage to us, especially with regard to the landmines. Now try to lure them down the pavilion end as much as possible. They can't possibly find their way back through the swamp. Well, when you meet Harrow on the field, we're going to go out there and lick them. I know it's unhygienic, but it's only polite. All right, lads, go out there and give them all you've got. Ah, Headmaster and Mr. Tottery.
Well, Flashman, I must say, they look a very fine team. Don't you think so, Mr. Dobfish?
What? Oh, yes, a very fine team.
There they go, corn school. Show them what you're made of. That's not what I meant, Dobkins.
What's happening?
Come on, school! Come on, school! Look at Tim Brown. Look at him go.
It's all right. He'll be back in a minute.
Yeah, there he is. He's got the ball. He's beaten one man. He's beaten two. My word, he knows how to use that cane.
He's running down the wing.
It's an open goal. Shoot, man. Shoot. Shoot. He's gone. He's scored. Well done. Well done. Scored, Mr. Totteridge, we scored.
Every hour. Hooray.
Hooray.
Funny game, Canasta.
What a match it was, with the cheers of the crowd roaring in our ears. Our 11 played like 50. Actually, we were 69. After it was over, we were all assembled in the main hall, and after we had been put together again, the headmaster swept in through the door and, putting aside his broom, stepped onto the platform.
Boys, I am very proud to be standing here before you. I never thought I'd sober up in time. Today, we won the game by 57-0. A magnificent effort. Pity the other team didn't turn up, but there it is. Hero of the moment is, of course, our captain, Tim Brown. And now we'll all sing the school song. I see Mr. Totteridge at the piano, looking immaculate in white tie and tails. Insofar as the piano can look immaculate in white tie and tails. Boys, let us sing.
Tune brings to an end another edition of I'm Sorry I Read That Again, which was written this week by Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, Eric Idle, and Bill Oddie. Those taking part were Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, David Hatch, Joe Kendall, and Bill Oddie, who also wrote the songs. The music was provided by Dave Lee, with arrangements by Leon Cohen, and the whole show was produced by Humphrey Barclay. No flowers by request. So that's it until the same time next week, when once again John Otto Cleese will say in stentorian tones.
In stentorian tones.
Okay. We'll have to stop for this message. Don't go away.
The Radio Theater Channel. OldTimeRadioListen.com. You are not listening to the BBC. You are listening to...
The Kevin Curtis Show!
Come in. Ah, Horn.
You sent for me, sir?
Yes. As controller of Fort Word and Deed of the BBC, I'm afraid I have to reprimand you over the use of certain words and phrases contained in last week's show.
Oh, what specific phrases did you have in mind?
Well, last week in your show, you distinctly said, hello.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Oh, come off it, Horn. We all know what hello means. We all know what it suggests. It suggests, hello, what's this I see through the keyhole? It's a scantily clad female doing an exotic dance with a ball of wool.
Good heavens, is that what it suggests?
Yes, that's what it suggests to me.
Oh.
Immediately. And then later in the program, you said you were going to introduce someone without further ado, which suggests immediately that there had been some ado going on. Which brings me to your name.
My name, or what's wrong with Kenneth Horn?
Well, everybody knows that ground-up Moose's horn is an aphrodisiac. The very title of your show is an incitement to loose living and carrying on. I found. You'll have to change your name.
For the next 30 minutes, it's Round the Larksley Fortinbras. I can't wait till the controller gets round to Housewife's Choice. Well, now, today, as everybody knows, is the start of Cota Sheep in Raspberry Jam Week. And to celebrate the occasion, the City of London has gone gay and organised a really exciting festival. There'll be swan upping at Downham, swan downing at Upham, streptococcus racing at the BMA Recreation Grounds, Walthamstow, and an auction of Rembrandt's dentures at Sotheby's Horsemeat Boutique, Hungerford Arches. And for racing fans, the week's events will be crowned by the nudists' annual point-to-point at Kempton Park. And I can't wait to see them jogging around the course. All right, Smith, make the announcement.
And now, Armpit Theatre presents a story of horror and lurking fear. We give you Gaslight, Son of Flicker.
The year is 1890. The place, Victorian London. Inspector Delarose of the CID was going through his file of unsolved crimes with his dour Cockney assistant, Sergeant Molecule.
Well now, Sergeant, what about the Chalk Farm case? Have you dragged the hip bath?
Yes, sir. We sent Frogman down, but all they come up with is a sliver of carbolic, a pair of flippers, a bar of chocolate, one roller skate, a waterlogged copy of Memoirs of a Harem Girl and a false beard. But there's no sign of the bishop himself.
No. Have you tracked down the hooded finger burglar of Brixton yet?
We traced the footprints in the semolina to the boudoir of Lady Crabthrobber. And in her wardrobe, we found this.
Oh, that's why I left it. Well, once I get the tea leaves out, it'll be as good as new. Well, that only leaves the strange business at 14 Ganderbody Square still unsolved.
Oh, what do we have on that case, sir?
Precious little. The Countess of Ponder's End was foully done to death with a blunt instrument. Namely, a blunt instrument. And the house was ransacked, but we never found the assailant.
Did you know that a couple had moved into the house?
Yes, the Grunter Pulpits. They're just married, and she seems a sweet little thing, but Polyp Grunter Pulpit, her husband, he's odd. He's very odd indeed.
Good morning, Polyp.
Good morning, my dear.
I'm glad you're in such a good mood this morning. Aren't you coming down to breakfast, dear?
No, I'll have it up here where I am, on the chandelier. Did you sleep well last night?
Not really, Polyp. I was frightened.
Frightened? What was there to be frightened of? I was out.
I heard noises, and the gas light went very low.
Nonsense, you imagine things, my dear.
I didn't imagine it. I heard footsteps coming from the attic.
Mice.
And foul oaths and curses.
Ill-bred mice. I'm worried about you, my dear. You're not well. Here, lay down on this bacon slicer. Let me get you something.
What?
Sliced.
Polyp, we've been married for 6 weeks now, but every night you go out, not returning until the dawn. Where do you go?
To work.
But you're an upholsterer.
I'm an all-night upholsterer. You worry too much, my dear. Let me comb your hair with this axe.
Why are you looking at me so strangely, Polly?
You forgot to give old Spot his weekly bath yesterday.
But why should I have to bathe him? He's your father. I know what you're up to, Polyp. You're trying to drive me mad. But yesterday when you were out, I tried the attic door. It was locked, Polyp. Why was it locked?
Because I say so. You must never go in there.
But the room next door is locked too.
You must never go in there either. No, never, never, ever, not never on any account. Do you hear? You must never go in that room. Well, not to the plumber's vein.
What? You're mad.
Did you say mad? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Mad?
Yes.
Mad? Did you call me mad?
Yes.
I thought so earlier. I have to speak up. I'm not wearing my appliance. It's not me who's mad, my dear. It's not me who's mad. It's you.
Me?
Yes, you keep losing things.
What have I lost?
Answers, please, on a postcard. To the Lost Property Office, Baker Street, New Guinea.
I'm going to have you put away.
No.
Dr. Otterbland will do the necessary. Come in, Dr. Otterbland.
A secret door on the whatnot opened, and into the room stepped the kindly old family physician, Dr. Otterbland, an imposing man with beetling brows that met in the middle of his back.
My dear, yes, your husband has told me all about you. Come with me, my dear.
Where are you taking me?
To Somerset and Dr. Croke Raven's private residential hotel for loony gentlefolk. Yes. Don't worry, my dear, it's a trust house. All of us. All our residents are trust.
Go with him, my dear. The doctor will never be far away. He has a private practice in Bath.
Yes, every morning. The acoustics are better in there.
No, I won't go. I won't go. You can't make me go.
Oh, can't I? Grab her, Otterbland. I mean, grab her, Otterbland. Give her an injection.
No, don't
shrink away, my dear. It's only an 8-inch hypodermic needle. It won't hurt a bit. There. It only goes to show how wrong you can be.
Oh, she's gone limp. Help me carry her out. There's a horse-drawn mini-cab waiting.
But meanwhile, a watch was being kept on the house by Edwin Braden, disguised as Epping Forest. Without any artificial aid. To speak of, anyhow. Seeing the unfortunate Mrs. Gunter Pulpit being bundled into a hansom cab, he paused, only to knock back 18 pints at the captain's cabin before making his way speedily to the yard.
Excuse me, sir.
He speaks. Ladies and gentlemen, you are in the presence of history. It's as if Zeus had descended from Mount Olympus disguised as a water buffalo. Speak on, O Braden, speak on.
They've done a moonlight flit.
I beg your pardon?
Well, that's what it says here.
Is that all?
Yes.
Well, it's hardly worth getting off your podium for. Right, Sergeant Molecule, we haven't got a moment to lose. Not so fast, Grunter Pulpit. We're on to your little game.
Look out, he's got a bottle of liquid paraffin.
And it's loaded. One false move and we all go together.
Drop that liquid paraffin. I've got the letter here. And I'm not afraid to use it.
Drop that Beretta. I've got a Tommy gun.
Drop that Tommy gun. I've got a 12-bore Douglas Smith here and it's cocked.
But it's only a sawed-off Douglas Smith, sir.
Well, then it's half-cocked. But this is no time to haggle.
Drop that sawn off half-cocked Douglas Smith. I've got a stick of dynamite here.
Drop that stick of dynamite.
Look. Yeah!
That was the end of the affair. The others were never seen again. But blast plays funny tricks. My trousers were blown off and the blast threw me several hundred feet in the air. And I came to rest in the drawing room of a Mrs. Evadne Spigot of Morepose, Sidcup. At least that's what I told Mr. Spigot when he came home unexpectedly from work.
Round the horn colour supplement.
First, with a few new wrinkles on cookery and a great many old wrinkles elsewhere. Here is Daphne Whitefire.
Good news for all housewives. Rhino is down in the shops this week and you can give hubby his favourite cut. My suggestion... Best end of Rhino. The difficulty is, of course, to know which is the best end. Rhinos know, but their cause is not ours. Other goodbyes are a scallop of vole, water buffalo chestnuts, and hippo in its shell. For those of you who fancy something a little more exotic in the way of poultry, why not try duck-billed platypus flambé?
Yeah. Well, I've tried it, but they keep blowing the match out. Well, now, This week, the Round the Larkspur 14 Brass Colour Supplement turns its attention to the cinema. We in England have a great tradition in filmmaking, particularly during the war, when we made those never-to-be-forgotten epics of Keep It Up, Stick It Out, Take It on the Chin. I knew you'd all volunteer. Good heavens, an orange. Jack, darling, what's happening to us? School of Film. Here's an excerpt from one such naval drama starring Dame Celia Millstrangler and aging juvenile Binky Huckaback.
Oh, Charles.
Oh, Fiona.
Charles, Charles, you're back.
Yes. Would you mind scratching it?
There, darling. Better.
Yes, darling. Oh, how I've missed that. Seems years since I was home on leave last.
Did you think of me out there?
Yes. Constantly, incessantly, never-endingly I thought of you back here. And did you think of me out there, back here?
Yes. All I could think of back here was you out there thinking of me back here. Thinking of you out there, back here. Needing you, wanting you, wanting to need you, needing to want you.
I want to feel you need me. I want to feel you're there behind me leading the way. And how are the children? All I know of them is what you've written to me. Emily, how's she? And Peter, Roger, Sydney, Jonquil, Rupert, Abdullah, and... You know, I've wondered a lot about young Abdullah while I've... And... Buster. How's young Buster? Is he in long trousers yet? Is he going out with girls? Does he look like me?
Buster's the dog, darling.
I must go now.
When will you be back?
I don't know. I have a funny sort of premonition I won't be coming back.
You mean...
Yes. But if I don't get back, don't grieve. Just think... At last, he's found a little rest. A little peace.
A little peace, Charles.
Yes. She's a barmaid at Chatham.
These days, making films is no longer the prerogative of the large Hollywood companies. Today, many of the best films are made by the small, independent film units. And recently, I visited the office of one such company. The sign on the door said, Bona Prods. So I prodded and entered. Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian. This is my friend, Sam.
Oh, hello.
We are in the forefront of your new film, Vague. That Vague, Vague, you see that is actual French.
Yes.
Actual French.
Means we are of the new wave.
Yes,
wave.
And very nice it looks on you too.
Yes. You see, we've got a small independent unit, film unit,
yes.
You
yes.
see.
We are the Cecil B's of the 16 DeMille.
Yes.
Small budget pictures, really.
Would I have vardered any of them, do you think?
Oh, it's all the Polari, isn't it?
I wonder where he picks it up.
Yes, well, yes, well, Miss Drawn, you may have vardered one of our tiny bijou masterpiece X, Heart Face. one of our pictures was we made was Funny Eek and My Fair Pallone. And...
I take it you're engaged in something pretty exciting at the moment.
No, no, not really. We're just standing here with our hands on our lips talking to you.
Oh, bold, very bold.
Oh. wonder where he spends his evening. Oh, yes, you mean the subjects. Oh, well, friendly Mr. Horn, at the moment, we are dickering, aren't we, Jewel?
Yes, we are.
Just dickering.
Got one or two germs, and we're dickering with
That's
them.
That's right, germs, my dear.
Yeah,
germs, my dear.
We was thinking of a biblical subject, lovely. So,
in fact, I was up all last night working on me outline.
Show it to Mr. Horn.
What?
Show him your outline.
Oh, shall I?
Yes. Sure.
Well, look, this is how I see it.
Gary sees it, Mr. Orr. Your present, the moment of cinema history, he's about to create. He's about to create. Look at his features. All bent tortured. He's getting all worked up. Look, the muse.
No, no.
The muse is fluttering about and looking for a place to perch.
Yes, you see.
There she is. Go it, girl. There she's lighting on his shoulder.
I've got it.
He's got it, Mr. Orr. It's coming over him in waves.
Yes. We're going to do Samson and Delilah.
Go on, Jewel. How do you see it? How do you see it?
Well, I see Samson. And all huge and all bush.
Bush, yes, yes.
These bush. Great bulging thews and.
Oh, yeah.
And the whopping great. Whopping great lally.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. The film opens with him lying there, spark out on his palliass.
Oh.
And suddenly there's a movement behind the arras.
Yes.
And who comes trolling in?
Oh, shut up.
No, yes.
Trolling in.
Calling me thought.
No, no.
Who comes trolling in but this Pallone Delilah?
Yeah.
She varders his sleeping eek. And she pulls out this pair of scissors and lops off his right.
Yes, I see that. Yes, a great close-up of his head. Nanty Raya. Yes. That is your cinema verite.
Yes.
That is your cinema verite.
Truth. Then suddenly,
yeah.
He comes round.
Yeah. Mm. Go on. Mm. Yes.
He comes round.
What happens? What happens?
What?
What happens when he comes
I'll
round?
I'll tell you what.
Yes.
It's all ebbing away, he screams. It's all ebbing away.
Ebbing away. Lovely dialogue. Yes. Go on. Come on.
Then the Philistines come and they mock him, Mr. Orme.
Oh, they mock him. What a figure of tragedy he represents.
Then they drag him up the king's latty.
Oh.
And chain him.
Oh.
Chain him by his lallies to the pillar.
Oh.
Then he gets his wild up.
He gets his wild up.
Yes,
yes.
He do. And then with one mighty heave.
Oh.
Oh. He brings the whole latty tumbling about their heads.
Oh.
End of film.
Bravo, Jewel. Yes. Bravo. It's an Oscar winner. I shall go again and again. What about you, Mr. Orr?
Well, yes, it makes me want to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
And who do you see playing the role of Samson?
Where do you see the description? Say he's big, butch, muscular, blonde. There's only one person it can be.
Who's that?
Jewel, Jewel itself. It's you, Jewel.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, pity.
Why?
I saw myself as Delilah.
Promised me a couple of tickets for the sneak privada. Well, that brings us almost to the end of the show, but for this week's musical adventure up the highways and byways of folk music and stopping off in a lay-by, what else would we find but Rambling Sid Rumpole?
Well, hello, me dearie, and I expect you're dying to know what I've pulled out of me gander bag this week.
Yes, well, we're all agog. Well, half agog, anyhow.
Half agog. Yeah. Well, the air with which I'm about to burst forth is traditional in Lincolnshire. It is the song of the Bogle Clencher and goes after this fashion. When I was a clencher's bogle man in famous Lincoln town, I often clenched me bogling fork for less than half a crown. And I would wogle and nurk me boys, as I shall quickly tell. Oh, 'tis my delight on a shining night and a foggy night as well. Once I took me moolies and set them in a snare. 'Twas then I spied a sprout as man, a wordle in a hair. But I was not afeard, me boys, of that there is no doubt. Out is my delight on a shining night when the coppers aren't about. Although I'm over 80 now, my boggle still I clench, and I will flutter my artifacts at any passing wench. I've tickled many a scribbling nut as on my way I go. Oh, tis my delight on a shiny night at 1 and 9 a throw.
I'm afraid I don't have 1 and 9 on me. Well, that brings us to the end of the show for this week, except for a police message. Now, police are still looking for the nude cyclist of Polperro, and they wish to interview a tall, distinguished, middle-aged radio comedian with a bald head and a deep, fruity voice. Oh. So, until next week, then. Ciao.
Good evening and welcome to That's Fantastic, where we interview people with incredible stories. My guest tonight is Mr. Reginald Periwinkle of Edmonton, Alberta. Mr. Periwinkle's claim to fame is that he's met more famous people in the world than anybody else. Good evening, Mr. Periwinkle.
Good evening.
Tell us, Mr. Periwinkle, some of the famous people you've met over the years.
Yes, well, there's President Kennedy.
Very famous indeed.
There was General de Gaulle.
Oh, yes, very famous.
And there was Winston Churchill.
Wonderful.
Karl Marx.
Really?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Mr. Periwinkle, Karl Marx died over 100 years ago. How could you possibly have seen him?
Well, I did.
That's impossible.
Are you calling me a liar?
You're much too young to have met him. How old are you?
177.
You liar.
That's insulting.
You're a lying liar.
I'm going home, you mean man.
Good. Go home. That's all for tonight's show. But tune in next time when we meet a woman who can stand on her head while eating an apple on That's Fantastic.
Well, that's all for now. Goodbye.
The Kevin Curtis Show was written by Jim Dolan and Kevin Malin and is an REN production. And that is the Kevin Curtis Show, a program you can hear on Sundays, and go to oldtimeradiolisten.com and check out the schedule on the blog page, and you'll find out exactly when you can hear that. Now here's another program you can hear on the Theater Channel Monday through Friday, and it's the Master Detective, Sherlock Holmes.
That Rewind brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson as he tells us about another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And you know what I wish I could share with you sometime? A bottle of Petri California Sherry. Have you ever tasted Petri Sherry? It's just perfect before dinner. Why, that Petri Sherry can change the usual before-dinner lull into a special event, and that's a fact. Just look at the clear color of Petri Sherry. It's a deep, rich amber, clear and cheerful looking. And wait till you taste it. That's when you find out for sure just how good a wine can be. That's when you find out just what I mean when I say that the flavor of Petri Sherry comes right from the heart of the grape. Try Petri Sherry by itself, or with hors d'oeuvres or canapés or whatever you call those little cocktail sandwiches. And say, if you like your sherry dry, well, then Petri California Pale Dry Sherry is the sherry for you. Just be sure the label says Petri, the proudest name in the history of American wines. And now let's look in on our old friend, Dr. Watson. Doctor?
I'm out here on the patio, Mr. Bartell. Come out and join me.
Quiet, Winnie. Quiet. Come on.
I see the welcoming committee's here.
Yes, little scoundrels. They begin to think they own this patio. Scoop them off the chair, Mr. Bartell, and settle yourself down.
All right. Off you go, boys.
Off you go. Go on. Off you go. That's it, my boy. As a matter of fact, it's rather appropriate that the puppy should be here tonight, as in the story that I'm going to tell you, a dog played a most prominent part.
A dog? What kind of a dog, Doctor?
No, 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 my boy, don't get me anticipating my story. For once, I'm going to start at the beginning.
Which was?
On a summer morning in 1890, not long after my marriage. I'd gone back to my private practice, you know, and Sherlock Holmes was living alone in our old Baker Street rooms.
You still saw him, I suppose.
Indeed I did, Mr. Bartell. In fact, occasionally I even persuaded him to forego his bohemian habits so far as to visit my wife and me. But to get back to my story, I'd been exceptionally busy that summer. In consequence, was feeling rather, shall we say, nervy and run down. So much so that Mary, Mrs. Watson, persuaded me to take a fortnight's holiday. We went down to the charming little village of Taplow on the lower reaches of the River Thames. But, as so often happens, the best-laid schemes of mice and men gang up to glare.
I guess the holiday backfired on you, Doctor, and you found yourself involved in a mystery. Maybe a mystery calling for the aid of your old friend Sherlock Holmes?
Quite correct, Mr. Bartell. We'd only been down there a couple of days when the trouble began. In fact, the whole thing became so involved that I thought the best thing to do was to put the whole strange story in a letter to Sherlock Holmes. This I did. And I can imagine how he chuckled when he read my...
Dear old Watson, seems to be a little out of his depth. My dear Holmes, I need your help, or at least your advice. 2 days down here and I've become involved in a most unusual problem. It began this morning when Mary and I were out for an after-breakfast stroll. The sun was shining, the birds were singing, and there seemed every indication of it being a happy and careful...
You know, Mary, I've always thought up to now that barney was rather a silly word.
I still do, John, dear.
Nevertheless, it's the only possible word that describes a day like this adequately.
Very well, dear, it's barney. Personally, I'm so happy to see you relaxing that I don't care what the weather's like. You've been working much too hard.
Yes, it's been a busy year.
Yes, and last year Sherlock Holmes monopolized most of your time. At least I've got you to myself for once.
Hey, you dear little thing, you... Always been rather jealous of my association with Holmes, haven't you?
Not jealous, dear. But I must confess his influence on you wasn't entirely for the good. He had a habit of teasing you out all night.
Well, you should be used to that, dear. After all, it happens often enough in my practice.
True, John, but on those occasions I know where you are and don't worry about you. And again, you copied so many of Mr. Holmes' eccentricities.
Hmm?
Keeping your tobacco in a Persian slipper, for instance. And, oh, John, look down. Do you see that woman walking across the field towards us?
Yes, what's the matter? Do you know her?
I'm not sure, but I think it's Ellen Warburton. I believe she does live somewhere near here.
And who is Ellen Warburton?
An old friend of mine. She's frightfully clever and advanced. She's interested in women's suffrage and all sorts of things.
Oh, sounds dreadful. Imagine giving women the right to vote. Their place is in the home.
It is Ellen. Ellen! Ellen! Ellen Warburton! Oh, how are you?
Very nice to see you again.
I'm Mary Watson now. This is my husband.
How do you do, Miss Warburton?
How do you do? Mary, I'd heard that you'd married. Aren't you a medical detective or something, Mr. Watson?
Not quite, dear.
I hold the degree of Doctor of Medicine from the University of London, madam.
But he's helped the great Sherlock Holmes on many of his cases.
That's how I've heard of him then. Do you mind if I walk with you a little way?
Of course not, Ellen. Come along.
Do you live near here, Miss Warburton?
About 4 miles away, Doctor, at Chevy Grange. I'm a glorified housekeeper for my uncle, Colonel Warburton.
Oh, dear, that sounds rather dull for you.
As a matter of fact, the state of my uncle's health at the present moment makes it anything but dull for me. That's why I asked if I might walk with you for a way. Well, what's the matter with him, Ellen? He's going mad before my eyes, and I can do nothing to help him.
Mad? Come now, Miss Warburton, surely you...
Doctor, I'm not an hysterical girl. In fact, I regard myself as something of a scientist. I studied physics for a number of years at Bristol University. And I tell you that my uncle is going insane.
What are the symptoms?
Most of the time, he's perfectly normal. But when these attacks are on him, he gets in the most frightful rages and says the strangest things. He's even complained of hearing a shrill, piping whistle that comes out of nowhere. I can't hear it, nor can anyone else. But uncle gets into the most dreadful state. I wonder... Would you have a look at him for me, Dr. Watson?
Well, I don't...
Of course. John will do everything he can.
Thank you so much. Then supposing you both come over for...
So, my dear Holmes, at 7 o'clock this evening, we found ourselves approaching Chevy Grange. It was rather a forbidding-looking place, covering a little more than an acre, I should say. As we stood waiting for admittance, I must confess that I was not entirely...
Gloomy-looking place, isn't it, Mary?
It is a little forbidding, John, dear. Oh, dear. What's that?
Sounds like a tom-tom. Someone singing a weird chant. Seems to be coming from the direction of that barn over there.
It doesn't seem quite appropriate, dear, does it? I mean, not in the heart of Buckinghamshire. Why not knock on the door again, John?
Yes, it's all right, I will.
Perhaps they didn't hear it. Oh, they did.
Who is it? Oh, yes.
It's Dr. and Mrs. Watson, my good man.
Acker's the name, sir. Come in, please. The Colonel's expecting you, sir. He's in the study. This way, sir.
By the way, Hacker, as we were waiting outside the front door, we heard a strange chant, and it sounded as if someone was beating a tom-tom.
Oh, that's her. That was Miss Nader. You'll be hearing more of her.
Promising beginning. Let's see what happened next. This very unpleasant fellow Hacker showed us into the study where we met Colonel Warburton. First, it was hard to believe that he was a sick man. He looked well enough, and his conversation was sprightly. Spent most of his army life in Africa as military governor in Zulu district. And the African spears and other trophies that lined his study walls bore mute evidence to his past life. He encouraged me to tell him some of my own army experiences. Oh dear, poor fellow. It was really rather sad.
There I was, Colonel Warburton, on the howdah of this wretched elephant. The river was a raging torrent, and I couldn't get the confounded animal to budge. Well, I'm a pretty strong swimmer, you know. Won several cups of swimming, as a matter of fact. Of course, I was a much younger man then.
John, dear.
Yes, ma'am?
You interrupted Colonel Warburton's story.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Well, little incident would be interesting, sir.
Do go on, Colonel. Your story was so interesting. You were telling us that you were intercepted by an African drum code message.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I don't want to sound conceited, but I doubt if there was another Englishman in the world who could have told you what those particular drum beats meant.
Oh, I don't doubt that, Colonel Warburton.
Well, I'd spent a good number of years studying the native customs. I spotted the code right away. It meant that an uprising was planned to start throughout the whole province at noon the next day. Of course, there it is again. A devilish whistle. Can you hear a duck, Watson? Mrs. Watson?
I can hear nothing, sir.
Nor can I.
Of course not. No one can hear it but me.
No, Colonel Warburton, don't get so excited,
it's
sir.
It's black magic, that's what it is.
Oh, really, it's a black magic.
You must realize that the powers of jungle witchcraft are completely unknown in this country, Dr. Watson, but I know of them, and I can think of many people who might wish to employ them against me. Come in. Oh, it's you, Nada.
Great Scott, she's...
She's very beautiful.
Nada, I want you to meet some friends of Ellen's, Dr. and Mrs. Watson.
I am very pleased to meet both of you.
How do you do?
How do you do, Miss Nada?
Nada's father was a Chaga jeweler, one of the greatest Zulu chieftains I ever had the privilege of knowing. He did me the rare honor to swear blood brotherhood. For when the missionary sent Nada to England to complete her education, I insisted that she spend her first few months here under my wing. Listen.
What is it, Colonel?
That whistle again. For heaven's sake, say that you heard it this time. Please say that you did.
I didn't hear a thing, sir.
Well, I did, and I know where that sound came from.
Anna, put down that spear at once, will you, Colonel Warburton?
The devils are trying to kill me. I'll kill them first.
John! No, don't throw it, sir. Don't throw it. Someone's opening the door.
Uncle! Oh, it's Ellen.
Great Scott. The spear missed her by an inch.
Uncle, what is it?
Whistle. I heard it again, Ellen. And I'm going to find where it came from.
Poor Uncle. Of course, you heard no sound.
Nothing, Ellen. What can we do to help him, Dr. Watson?
Well, it's hard to say, Miss Warden. I'm not sure that medical help's what she needs. He seems perfectly sane and lucid, except for these strange outbursts.
But we must do something.
I propose to, madam. As soon as I get back to the inn, I think I'll write to my old friend Sherlock Holmes and ask his advice.
There's a problem. I can't feel that the man should be committed to an asylum, and yet, obviously, when these attacks are on him, he's as mad as a hatter. Well, fascinating problem, and one that calls for speedy action. I think a telegram to my friend Watson might help to clarify some aspects of the case. Yes. Let's see. John H. Watson, Red Lion Inn, Taplow Bucks. I suggest that you ascertain one important...
saying one important fact does the Warburton household have a dog. Telegraph reply, Holmes. Oh, upon my soul, that's a cryptic answer to my letter.
Yes, dear, it is. I'm afraid Ellen will be disappointed. He's coming over to join us for lunch to see if you have any news.
Well, what on earth can dogs have to do with the case?
I can't possibly. Here's Helen now. Good morning, Ellen.
Hello, Mary.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, good morning.
I suppose it's too early to have received any reply from Mr. Holmes.
Well, as a matter of fact, I just got this telegram from him. You can read it if you like. I can't see it makes much sense, Miss O.
But that's extraordinary. I did have a little dog. He was killed a week ago. But it didn't occur to me to tell you about it yesterday. Oh, that's amazing. How could Mr. Holmes have known about it?
It's very little that Holmes doesn't know, my dear. How was your dog killed, Miss Warburton?
I found him in the grounds with his head smashed in by a stone.
Oh, how dreadful.
Who do you think did it?
It might have been a poacher. And then again, it might have been...
Your uncle?
It's possible. When he's in those rages, I don't think he knows what he's doing.
That's very important. I think I shall go and send Holmes a telegram at once. Don't wait lunch for me.
Why did we have to walk over to the station, dear?
To see if there was an answer at the station telegraph office to the wire that I sent Holmes.
Oh, it's only 4:30, dear. It's hardly possible for him to have answered as quickly as that. In any case, they deliver the telegram to the hotel, you know.
Well, it was a nice walk, my dear. Hello, there's a train in the station now. I wonder where it's from.
Why don't you ask that porter, dear?
That's not a bad idea. Porter, what train is this?
Oh, it's the London train, sir. Right on time. Next stop, ready?
Not many people getting off, where are they? Greg Scott, look who's here.
Oh, dear, it's Mr. Holmes. And he's got a dog on a leash.
Oh,
what? My dear fellow, how are you? This is Watson. How nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
I'm delighted you're here, old fellow. We walked over to the station to see if you'd answer my telegram. You are in first.
It occurred to me that I could be down here the same time that it would take a telegram to reach you. And I decided that a day or two in the country would make a person change. Apart from the fact that Colonel Warburton's problem interests me enormously.
Why on earth did you bring a dog?
I thought that this was a case in which a dog would be of invaluable assistance.
Oh, be careful, John.
Yes, look out, old chap. I think it would be safer not to pat him. I picked him up in the Mile End Road for a couple of florins, and I fear he's a dog that should have remained in London. A singularly unattractive nature seems to have been entirely ruined by an honest train ride.
Unpleasant brute,
isn't he?
By the way, Holmes, what do you make of the case from my letters?
Well, I should prefer to reserve my judgment until I've met the Colonel. However, I will vouchsafe one opinion.
Oh, what's that?
To paraphrase a proverb, don't disbelieve all you don't hear.
I can't think why someone doesn't answer. They can't all be out.
Well, while we're waiting, I think I'll tie the dog up to this tree here. I don't want my arrival too much commotion. Quiet!
Do you think perhaps we could try the door, John?
Yes, certainly. It's a good idea. Hello, hello. It's unlocked.
Then let's go in, old fellow. Let's go in.
Colonel Warburton? Colonel Warburton?
Ellen?
What was the name of that butler fella?
Hacker.
Yes, well, that's it, Hacker. Hacker!
We appear to be in an empty house. The dog! Oh, fool that I am, I shouldn't have left him here. Come on! Ah. We're too late.
Oh, the poor dog. He's been killed.
Yes, poor brute. Stabbed to death by one of the colonel's spears. That proves it, Holmes. The man is mad.
I think not, Watson. I think it proves that Colonel Warburton is a great deal more sane than some of the members of his household.
And now back to tonight's new Sherlock Holmes adventure, the story of Colonel Warburton's madness.
Holmes, why are we heading for this barn? Seems to me we should be back in the house.
Why, old chap? Found the house empty. Besides, I thought I heard.
What is it?
Listen.
It's the same sound that Mary and I heard yesterday.
Once more, it's coming from the barn. Come on, Watson. But quietly.
Little girl, louder. She's beating a drum and chanting.
Who's the man with her?
It's Colonel Warburton. No, it isn't. It's that servant for a hacker. What in thunder is he doing here?
Apparently assisting Miss Nader in some of her
African mysticism. It's black magic they're dabbling with. Just as the Colonel said, let's go in and catch him red-handed.
No, no. Stay quiet. We'll talk to him soon enough. The moment I feel it's much more urgent that we find Colonel Warburton. Come on.
Well, there's the Colonel, pacing up and down in front of the house with Mary and his niece, Miss Warburton. We shouldn't have left the women alone with him, you know. The man's dangerous.
I don't think the women have been in any danger, Watson.
Dear, where have you been?
Oh, well, Holmes and I decided we'd take a little walk. It proved very interesting. Miss Warburton, this is Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
How do you do, Mr. Holmes? I'm so glad you're here.
How do you do, Miss Warburton?
And this is Colonel Warburton, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, eh? I suppose you think I killed your wretched dog. Well, I might have done it. When I hear that whistle, something seems to snap in my brain. I might have killed it. Why doesn't your doctor friend certify me as insane? Send me where I belong before I do any work, Debbie?
Poor man. Isn't there anything you can do for him, Mr. Holmes?
I most certainly will try to, Miss Warburton. What, no fellow? I wonder if you'd follow the Colonel and give him a sedative. I'm afraid he has quite an ordeal before him.
Of course I will, Holmes.
Miss Warburton, where were you when my dog was killed?
Down in the greenhouse. As soon as I heard the poor animal yelping, I ran up to the house.
I see.
Mr. Holmes, you are going to be able to help the Colonel, aren't you?
I'm convinced of it, Mrs. Watson. That is why I brought a dog from London. But now that he's dead, I must obtain another one before I can proceed further with the case. Now, I wonder where on earth I can find John.
Look. Huh? Down by the gate. There's a little girl walking with the dog.
That's Sarah Entwistle, the daughter of our neighbor.
Sarah, eh? Oh, excuse me, will you? Just a moment. Sarah!
Yes?
Sarah, my dear. What a pretty dog you have there. What's his name?
It's a her. Her name's Boojum. What's your name?
Holmes. Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock? That's a funny name.
Yes, yes, it is, isn't it? Look here, Sarah. Here's a nice, shiny half-crown for you.
Why are you giving me money?
Well, because I love dogs, my... I want to borrow, what did you call him?
Boojum.
Boojum, oh, yes, yes. I want to borrow Boojum for half an hour.
Why?
Well, I want to, I want to play with her, Sarah.
You can play with her here. She's awfully friendly.
Well, you see, I really want to take her for a nice walk.
Why? She's just had one.
Now, look here, Sarah. It's a beautifully shiny half-crown.
Mommy's told me I mustn't take money from strangers.
But I'm not a stranger. I'm a friend of Colonel Warburton.
Having trouble, Mr. Holmes?
Yes, I am, Mrs. Watson. You see, I want to give Sarah half a crown for borrowing Boojum for a short while, but she doesn't want to do it.
Sarah, does Boojum like bones?
Oh, yes. Loves them.
We've got a lot of bones up at the house we'd like to give her.
Have they got plenty of meat on them?
Plenty. She can have a wonderful feast, and then we'll bring her back in half an hour.
All right. Go on, Boojum. Now, promise you'll bring her back in half an hour.
We promise. Yes, Sarah. And Sarah, what about the half crown?
Well, I'll take it home and ask Mommy if I may keep it.
Good.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And take care of Boojum.
Oh, she's a sweet little girl. Mr. Holmes, you're not going to expose Boojum to any danger, are you?
None, Mrs. Watson, otherwise I shouldn't have heard her. I'm convinced that Boojum will give us the clue to what appears to be Colonel Warburton's madness. Now, let me see. We're all here. Miss Warburton, the Colonel, Miss Nada, and the dog Boojum, yes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I propose to conduct an experiment before I... conduct it, I should like to point out the chronology of the events in this case. First, Miss Nader arrived here.
Mr. Holmes, you're not suggesting...
Please let me finish, Miss Nader. First, Miss Nader arrived here. Second, the Colonel first heard the mysterious whistle. Third, your dog was killed, Miss Warburton. Fourth, the whistling set in dead earnest. The Colonel Warburton and Miss Warburton. Doesn't that pattern suggest anything to you?
No, I
Can't say that it does, Mr. Holmes.
I don't see what you're driving at.
Nor do I, Holmes. I wish you'd be more specific.
Very well, then I will. I shall now conduct my experiment. I want you all to watch Colonel Warburton and the dog, Boojum. Excuse me while I turn my back. Now.
There it is again. That whistle. The dog heard it, too.
Great God, Holmes. What does it mean?
It means that this wooden whistle in my hand is the answer to the mystery. The sound made by this cunningly designed instrument is above the normal range of pitch. You see, the colonel has hypersensitive ears.
But the dog heard it.
Perhaps I should have said the normal human range of pitch.
Didn't you suppose someone has deliberately been trying to drive the colonel mad?
Of course, Mayor. That's why the dogs were murdered. Whoever it was knew that a dog would give the game away.
It's not hard to guess who that someone is. Nada, this started when you came here. Is this your gratitude for the colonel's kindness to you? Endangering his sanity with your evil black magic?
That is not true.
One moment, please, Miss Warburton. Miss Nada.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Dr. Watson and I watched you in the barn some 3/4 of an hour ago with Hacker. Were you engaged in practicing any form of black magic?
No. I was praying to my old gods to save the colonel's sanity.
What were you doing there, Hacker? Don't tell me you were praying to old gods, too.
Well, I used to be a chapel-going man, sir, but I don't know. No harm in trying something new, I always say.
In any case, why should Miss Nada wish to persecute the colonel?
It might be for some tribal revenge.
Oh, but that's ridiculous, Ellen. Her father and I were sworn blood brothers.
Exactly, sir. Now, it should be obvious. Who had a motive for making the colonel appear mad is niece and heiress.
What do you mean?
She had studied physics, you will remember, and so could know about supersonic research. Possibly she was afraid the colonel might leave his estate to Miss Nada. And so wished him to appear insane and thereby invalidate a new will.
What?
In any case, I found this whistle in a drawer in your room, Miss Warburton.
Ellen, how could you?
I did it for your sake, to save you from Nada. She's just an adventuress, only you won't see it.
Colonel Warburton, what action do you wish me to take regarding your niece, Miss Warburton?
My niece? I have no niece, Mr. Holmes. Come, Nada, my dear.
Oh, what an amazing case, Holmes. Mary, wasn't it cool the way Holmes solved it?
It was very interesting, dear. I was quite enthralled.
Oh, now I think I shall return to London and let you two finish your holiday in peace.
Before you do that, Mr. Holmes, there's one thing we should do.
What, Mary?
Boojum. We promised, you know.
Yes, of course. I think the three of us might walk her home. But before we do that, I suggest we rummage through the kitchen.
The kitchen? What on earth for?
Bones, dear.
Exactly. And bones with plenty of meat on them.
Say, Doctor, that was a swell story. And look, you mean there really is a whistle that only dogs can hear?
I thought you'd ask me that question, so I've got one of those whistles to show you. There.
Well, there's nothing unusual about it. Blow it, Doctor.
Well, listen, Mr. Bartell, if I want you to come quickly, I don't just have to whistle. All I have to say is, would anybody like a glass of pet wine? And, hey, presto, there you are.
Well, can you blame me? I know a good wine when I hear it. And Petri wine sure is good wine. It ought to be. The Petri family's been making wine for generations. As you know, ever since they started the Petri business way back in the 1800s, that business has always been family-owned and operated. So just think of all the experience the Petri family's gained. They've been able to hand on down from father to son, all they've ever learned about the art of turning luscious California grapes into fragrant, delicious wine. So whenever you're choosing a wine to serve before dinner, with dinner, or at any time, you can't go wrong with a Petri wine. Because Petri took time to bring you good wine. Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure is written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and is based on an incident in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, The Engineer's Thumb.
Thanks for joining us and learning more about the old-time radio programming of the Radio Theater Channel. We'll be back next week with more, so...